Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundtable of the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this week, crews replaced highway signs along the Wasatch Front, upping the speed limit to 70 miles per hour in many areas. But does going faster generate more pollution, a problem in the urban corridor? We'll find out why air quality advocates are worried. Also, the shortlist for a new state prison location made many local communities mobilize against being picked. We'll find out more about why folks in West Jordan, Eagle Mountain, and other cities don't want the prison in their backyard. And Governor Herbert wants more money to fund public schools, a lot more money. We'll find out details about his budget proposal. The week's top stories, plus Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Kirby. Stay tuned for Behind the Headlines, coming up after the news. Welcome to Behind the Headlines. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce with the Salt Lake Tribune. And today on the program, we've got speed limits, the prison move, the budget, much more. And joining me this morning to talk about the week's news is Tribune investigative reporter Matt Canna. Matt is in the house. Hello.
Hello.
Also with us, education and environment and health editor. That's a very long title, Rebecca. Rebecca Walsh is back. And hi, Rebecca.
Hello.
And with us also, the editorial writer, George Pyle. George, welcome.
Good morning.
And you can join us, too. If there's a news story on your mind, you can send your questions and comments to the hashtag TribTalk on Twitter and Google+. Put your comments on the website, sltrib.com, or give us a call live, 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255. Let's start with air quality. The buzz this week has been on the state raising highway speed limits along the Wasatch Front, and people no longer have to drive 65, I guess, Rebecca?
If you trust what the Highway Patrol is saying, you can't go over 75 anymore. So I guess we'll have to see if they start enforcing that. I haven't noticed people being ticketed yet on I-80 when they're going 80. But so, yeah, air quality advocates were sort of caught by surprise with this speed limit increase. I guess the speed limit bill was not on their registry of air quality bills, and so this caught them by surprise. I think it frankly caught a lot of people by surprise because the public comment period seemed to come and go so quickly. So air quality advocates have sort of been back on their heels, and they're a little concerned because this strikes them as sort of inconsistent with what they thought was an initiative on the Wasatch Front to try to diminish emissions.
What is the connection between pollution, emissions, and speed?
Well, the science is sort of conflicted. The state air quality did its own study to see if emissions would increase going from 55 to 75, and they thought that the emission rate would be negligible. Air quality advocates challenge that, and they say that the state study doesn't take into account greater VOC, volatile organic compounds evaporating from tailpipes when you go faster. Mm. It also doesn't take into account that people are just going to be burning more gasoline as they drive faster.
Okay.
So,
Here's UDOT's argument. They say, you know, the change is really not going to affect air quality because people are already going this fast. They are just legitimizing current behavior. So, I mean, how do the air qualities advocates respond to that?
I think air quality advocates think that the state is an outlier. We're an outlier in the Intermountain West because most of the states around us keep the speed limit to 65. And Tennessee actually reduced its speed limit because they were trying to cut into some of their pollution problems. Hmm. And they had a study in Tennessee that found that NOx emissions, nitrogen oxide emissions from trucks, decreased 18% if you cut the speed limit 10 miles per hour. So the science in Tennessee contradicts what the Utah scientists are saying. So air quality advocates are hoping that they can convince lawmakers and the governor to take this back down, but I think that's kind of a long shot at this point. Once you raise the speed limit, it's pretty hard to take it back down.
Yeah. George, what arguments persuade you?
Well, I think the main thing is that what they're doing is they're just saying this is how fast people drive, and we're just going to let them drive that fast. I had a traffic engineer tell me one time that the real way to set speed limits is to open a road, not put a speed limit on it, and go out there and measure how fast everybody goes. And like 85% of that is what your speed limit ought to be. And maybe that's what they're doing here. I think it does impact emissions, and perhaps more on down the line. I mean, the air quality advocates are not just focused on what the air quality is like on I-15 at a certain point, they're thinking about how you burn more gas. That means you have to refine more gas. That means you have to drill more oil. And all the way down the pipeline is what they're concerned about, and not just whether you're creating more pollution at a specific point on a specific day. And of course, and the state also is pretty big on that the main worry about auto emissions is in those first 5 minutes after you start your car, before your catalytic converter warms up. They've really hung their hat on that, and that, and getting Tier 3 gasoline. And so other things beyond that, they don't seem to worry about too much. I don't know that this was necessary, but I agree with Rebecca. I don't see the legislature or anybody stepping in and saying, no, you have to drive slower, because we just love to drive.
Well, and Rebecca, you mentioned the ticketing. You don't see a lot of tickets out there for speeding. Yeah. I don't know.
It's not scientific. I'm driving on I-80, but people are still going 80 on I-80 and nobody's getting ticketed. Mm-hmm. The other thing that I think is interesting for air quality advocates is to watch this happen, while at the same time you have the governor proposing an outright ban on burning during the winter. Now,
this is wood burning, your
wood burning
stove
in your own home.
Yeah.
So the state seems to be at cross purposes here. We're going to increase the speed limit, but we're going to stop you from burning in your own home.
This week, I think it was actually last night, the Salt Lake County Board of Health held a hearing about banning wood burning on all bad air days. And again, the governor has proposed this idea of banning wood burning for areas that don't meet the EPA standards outright from November to March. Mm-hmm. I mean,
so Salt Lake County would be ahead of the state for 8 months.
Right.
The state ban, if it happens, would not go into effect until next November. And there will be a series of 7 meetings throughout the state.
And there are a lot of people who are very upset about this from a different number of different angles. Maybe, mm-hmm. Rebecca, you can describe that controversy. Yeah.
We're hearing from a lot of people who have bought those new EPA-approved stoves, spent $2,500 to $5,000 on new stoves so that they can burn, and now the governor's telling them they can't burn even with those EPA-approved stoves. We're also hearing from the Patio and Hearth Association, which obviously has an economic interest in this argument, and they would say that you should allow people with EPA-approved devices to burn up to red burn days. So they're pushing back pretty hard, and I think that the economic argument may overwhelm the air quality argument in this case.
And you do have the air quality advocate saying wood smoke is toxic. It's more toxic than we even imagine, that the new research shows that. So there is this tussle. George, the editorial page is calling it the No Burn Noel. Maybe you can describe.
Yeah, I mean, it's as Rebecca said, I mean, people like their ovens, their stoves, or fireplaces. They spend a lot of money on them in some cases. And it's one of the reasons people like to live around here. You have the crisp winter mornings, and you want to put a log on the fire. And then somebody comes along and tells you, well, you know, that's bad for the air. And the studies, you know, were done here at the University of Utah that were telling us just how much just wood burning matters compared to, and it's a staggering amount compared to automobile emissions and everything else.
Well, they're comparing it to smoking a pack a day.
They're a small proportion of the total, but they're more toxic for you than emissions from a car.
Robert Gerke's
right.
in the studio.
The study said, and the sort of the shocking figure about it is that burning a wood-burning stove for an hour emits the same amount of pollution as driving a car to St. George and back. No. So, you know, it's pretty extraordinary the amount of emissions these put out. And when we have these inversion days, they can make a difference, even though there are only, I think, about 150 to 200 homes that have primary heat source that's a wood-burning stove.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And the governor did put in his proposed budget money to help those people move to a different source of heat so that they could get away with that. We could tell them to stop burning and not insist that they have no heat in their homes.
Mm-hmm. And yet no one has applied for that money. Yeah, up to this point.
People are not
applying for this money, no. Even though it's available. There's this weird dichotomy going on here.
Do they know about it?
The state seems to think so, but they're trying to add to the list of people, of sole source burners, to try to get at more of those people offer the money to them.
The state went out and tried to inventory all of these homes that have a primary source of heat that's a wood-burning stove, and then encourage them to take part in this. And some of the people are You know, just they don't want to do it. Wood is cheap, you know,
in a lot of cases.
They're sort of, they're off the grid.
They get
people.
Free wood.
And frankly, you know, furnaces are expensive. And if you're going to, you know, even with the incentive you have, you still have to operate the thing, and it's going to cost you more than it costs to go out and scavenge for a fallen tree or something like that.
Right. Well, Robert, maybe you can bring in the legislative part of this. We were talking about the speed limit. Mm-hmm. We're talking about wood burning. How are lawmakers going to be thinking about this next month?
Well, it's funny because of the weather patterns we have in this state, every time the legislature comes into session, it's always a murky kind of crappy day. And so, you know, it's something that they are sort of hammered over for the first, you know, month and a half of the session when the weather's bad. And miraculously, as the air clears, the pressure on them to do something sort of eases. They've tried to do some of these things with incentives. They've tried to, you know, they're looking at, as George mentioned, the governor has a couple initiatives in his budget to trade out both wood-burning stoves and things like lawnmowers that have high emissions to provide incentives for that for homeowners and businesses. That may or may not get traction. I mean, the incentive programs tend to be, you know, the legislature is a little reluctant to do things on it. One of the other things they're looking at is the governor had $20 million to upgrade the bus fleet for school buses. A lot of the buses, the older diesel buses, are not as clean as the newer ones. And if you swap those out, you do something. But yeah, every year there's pressure for them to do something. And every year there's frustration, I think, from the activist community that they don't do enough.
Hmm. Rebecca, what are you hearing from the advocates? How are they strategizing at this point to keep air quality front and center?
I think they're hoping that they can take this to the governor and that the governor might push back. But again, I think once you change those signs on the freeway, it's pretty hard to change them back. Maybe they'll try to negotiate for something else. Maybe they hope that they could get some traction on other issues during the session if they give up on this one.
Well, and the broad sentiment among the legislature last year was that, you know, that the science that they were given showed, you know, as Rebecca mentioned, showed that they're convinced that it's not actually more polluting or significantly more polluting than it is. And so I think it is an uphill battle for them to have any hope of actually changing this back.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it is one of those things where, I mean, every time somebody proposes something to improve air quality, it's like, why are you picking on me? Go do them. They're worse than me. So that's why it's auto emissions versus wood stoves versus refineries versus fire pits in
versus
backyards.
Pizza ovens.
Versus pizza ovens versus restaurants. And everybody says, and then if you say, well, we're going to cut down on auto emissions, well, that affects almost everybody. So, I mean, if the lowering the speed limit really would make a difference in auto emissions, but people don't want to do anything to improve air quality. They want somebody else to do something to improve air quality.
How do you change that mindset?
And it's, well, I mean, maybe you can find some way where we all lock hands and jump into the volcano at once. But, I mean, the politically smart way to do it, which may be beyond our reach, is to put together a package where everybody gives a little bit. Tier 3 gasoline, Tier 3 auto emission standards, those are things that are on their way. The governor is trying to accelerate them. Those would be the kinds of things that might increase the cost of owning and driving a car a very small amount. And when we get there, we will have done quite a bit and probably have made up for any emissions increase caused by a higher speed limit. And then the auto driving public can say, well, look, we've made a difference. Now let's pick on the refiners or let's pick on the drive-through lanes. I mean, if we're really serious about it, we ought to not allow any more drive-throughs, banks, restaurants, mm-hmm. anything else. But that'll never happen either.
It's true, though. I mean, and the scope of this issue is pretty significant because depending on what study you look at, somewhere between 40% and 60%, I think, of the pollutants are tailpipe emissions. And so, you know, if you're going to attack the problem, this is the area that these driving habits, pollutants from the tailpipe are the things you've really got to go after because that's where most of it's coming from. That's where you can make small changes and have the biggest impact.
There was such a groundswell outcry last year, though, and I don't feel that this year. Am I the only one who's sort of sensing some silence on this issue?
Well, I think we haven't
had
a major inversion yet, and it hasn't been cold enough for that once we get into it.
And given the weather patterns we've got the next week and a half, you're probably going to see one before too long.
Yeah. You're listening to Behind the Headlines here on KCBW. Again, you can join us too. 801-355-TALK is our number. Send a tweet to the hashtag TribTalk. We need to take a quick break. We'll be right back. Stay with us. Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce. Joining me today, reporters Matt Canham and Robert Gerke, also with us, editorial writer George Pyle, and health, education, and environment editor Rebecca Walsh. And of course, we're talking about the week's news. And you can join us by sending a tweet to the hashtag TripTalk or put your comments at sltrib.com. Call us live, 801-355-TALK is our number. Let's move on to the prison. This has been such a hot button issue this week and last. And there's a lot of talk about relocating the prison from Draper, where it's been for decades, to a new site. Cities that are on a short list are not happy. When the list of six shortlisted cities was released, it sparked protests. Our comment boards totally filled up with emotion. Maybe you can walk through the strategies of these six cities, Matt Canham. Start with Eagle Mountain. How are they sort of dealing with the reality that they are on the short list for the new state prison?
So Eagle Mountain, which is one of the fastest growing cities in the United States of America, it's in northern Utah County. It's part of the Cedar Valley, so which is an area that they're projected to have more than 100,000 people live there by 2050. And one of the co-founders of that city wants to put the prison right in the middle of that valley. The residents there are upset. Now what happens is that these residents then turn to their mayor and say, what are you doing about it? And the mayor says, well, I'm talking to the legislature, and they're like, we want more action. And so what the city council did this week is they had a meeting where they let all these residents voice their concerns, and they also agreed to spend up to $50,000 fighting this. They're talking about hiring a lobbyist and paying for signs and for mailers supporting a citizen-led group that's fighting this. Now, when you talk to the members of the state's Prison Relocation Commission, which are all state lawmakers, they're a little taken back by this. They expected some pushback, but they didn't realize the pressure on local officials to act. You know, some of these members are saying, look, Eagle Mountain might not even make the cut. They might be drop off by December 22nd, which is the next commission meeting. They're telling people to calm down. But if you're a mayor of a city, what are you supposed to do when people are saying, I don't want to live next to a prison?
There's no calming down. And similar outrage from Salt Lake City. I mean, they put up a wall early.
Salt Lake City's interesting. They're the only area that has, they have two proposed prison sites. Both are near the airport. There's no citizen-led group fighting it in Salt Lake City that I've seen, no at least large one. The city is fighting it. The city put a huge report down on the table early and said, just so you know, if you try to put a prison there, there's some wetlands, so there might be some environmental lawsuits. In some areas that have tried this, those lawsuits have lasted 10 years. So think twice before you try to put it here. That's their big warning. But you have areas like in Tooele County near the Miller Motor Sports Park where cities there are up in arms, and they held a protest yesterday. You have West Jordan, where the mayor there has held one press conference with surrounding mayors to fight it. They're holding another one on Monday. These communities are very upset, and they're starting to say, hey, I have an idea. Why don't we leave the prison where it is?
Hmm.
Why send your problem to me? And we're going to keep talking about that in the days to come, because there is some validity to that argument. Because if you ask the legislature why you're moving the prison, it said it's surrounded by development, that the land is very valuable, and that if the prison moves, the homes in that area will increase in value by $10,000 to $15,000. That's what the commission has said. Well, if you move it to one of these other cities, couldn't you then say, well, wait a minute, we're going to expand, so that problem's going to exist again, and then you're telling me my property value is going to decline.
Mm.
And so these people are very upset about it.
Here's a comment from Utah 101 on sltrib.com. I'd love it if the Tribune did an in-depth financial analysis of why the state wants to move the prison. I think if taxpayers saw how the state came up with their quote-unquote savings, the prison wouldn't be moving at all. And again, why are we moving the prison?
So, I mean, there's some argument. And this is not like this is something that came out of nowhere. The legislature has been talking about this for 3 years, and there has been multiple studies. And what it comes down to is the prison needs some remodeling, and they're putting that at about $250 million. That's going to happen regardless. So they're saying, okay, we have to spend $250 million, whether we do that on a new prison or this. And they're saying, if we sell this land under where the prison is now, the 700 acres, we could spend that money on building a new prison.
Mm-hmm.
And we can put it in an area where it's not in the heart of a city, where it is growing, and maybe they can use that land for better economic development purposes. There is an argument to be made that in the heart of this growing area, you don't want to have the stigma of a prison. The problem is, where do you put it that is close enough to the resources you need, like courts, hospitals, ambulances, but far enough away that you're not going to run into the exact same problem again.
In like 10 years.
Right. I mean,
these are fast growing.
If you go
areas.
To West Jordan, there's 14 subdivisions that are currently being expanded upon. If you go to drive out to Eagle Mountain or Saratoga Springs, these places are exploding with homes. Now, where they're saying they're going to put it, it will probably take a decade or two for the homes to reach there. But if anyone's been paying attention, homes are going to reach there.
George, the editorial page does not think much of hiring a lobbyist to prevent a prison relocation.
No, I mean, we understand why, because as Matt said, the people are up in arms and they want to see that their city council and their mayor are doing something, capital letters. So this is what they're doing. But it does strike us as a problem, and it's universal. It's in every state. It's everywhere you go. You would think that the mayor of a city, the mayor of a county, the city manager, whoever, could walk up to the state house in front of God and everybody and talk to his legislator and testify at a committee hearing. And that way, the people of the communities would have their say to the members of the legislature. But no, you've got to go hire a lobbyist. You've got to work the back halls. You've got to be in the caucuses and the meetings where normal people can't go in order to have any influence with the legislature. So one elected official talking to another elected official out in front of everybody is thought not to work. You have to do it this other way.
I would point out, this is not to take away from your point, but this is a little bit of a unique situation. The founder of Eagle Mountain is trying to put the prison in a city that the city doesn't want. No. His attorney is the state senator who represents that city,
no.
who has refused to talk to the mayor about this. And he's refused to talk to us about it. And he's refused to talk to the citizen group about it. That he's just gone into hiding. The person who's supposed to represent this area is not saying a word. His name's Mark Mattson, by the way.
Mm-hmm. Well, and who represents the town where the prison currently is? The new Speaker of the House.
Right.
This is a cyclical thing. I think Governor Huntsman ordered a study as soon as he came into office in 2004, and they decided then it was too expensive at $400 million. This is going to be a perennial argument because of, I think, the kind of community that Draper is and the way that Draper sees itself. So I sort of see it as being inevitable.
Mm-hmm. Robert, I mean, will lawmakers revisit keeping in Draper, do you think? Because of this groundswell of, opposition from these local communities.
It's certainly being suggested. I think the governor wants it moved. I think the legislature, by and large, wants it moved. But I think there's a lot of, from the legislators I've talked to about this, there's a lot of frustration with the six sites they've chosen. This isn't what they were expecting. They didn't expect it to move it from one developed area to another developing area. You know, it doesn't buy them the time that they were hoping to get out of it. It doesn't get them the savings and the long-term stability or long-term viability for the prison that they were hoping to get. And so there's a lot of frustration there. I think they'll have to revisit these six sites and maybe add some others to it, maybe look at some that were dropped off the list earlier. But you know, as George and Matt both mentioned, no matter where you put it, there's going to be a backlash and they're going to have to deal with that down the road, regardless of where this thing ends up.
George, what's the logical outcome? I mean, does this opposition mean it's just going to be put off longer and longer and longer into the future?
Well, our hope as an editorial board is that this might provide the state with an excuse just to quit and just leave the prison where it is, spend the money there. I mean, you could have a new facility, you could really be serious about doing something about recidivism and other things, so maybe you don't need as many cells as they're talking about if you really wanted to spend some effort and some money that way. And that would be a way for the state to justify spending some money to actually do something decent for somebody by saying, well, the payoff for everybody else is that we don't need as many prison beds. We could rearrange what we've got in Draper, maybe have the total footprint shrink. And maybe you could sell off some of that, especially frontage property or something, and build a big box store or something and satisfy the idea that we need economic activity. I don't know that that's really going to happen. I think that
he's going to say it's not
the fix is in, and but well, whatever they do,
they'll
and
force even it if, by the airport,
and even if they move it to the airport, or even if they move it to Tooele County, or even if they do something like that, the least they can do is stand up and incorporate this with some of the other recommendations that are out there about reducing recidivism, lowering some drug crimes from a felony to a misdemeanor, so that they don't go to jail, don't go to prison, and reducing the strain on whatever prison we have so it doesn't have to be so big.
And that is part of the plan. I mean, that is part of the legislation that created the Prison Relocation Commission. It is part of what the consultants there have hired are looking at. They've working with Pew on a series of legislation to change exactly the things that George just talked about, and those should be coming up in this year's legislative session.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but it is called the Prison Relocation Commission, not the Prison Study Commission or the Prison Future Commission. It's called the Prison Relocation Commission. So, yeah, that's what they're going to do.
Well, and they've been sold a grand vision for what Draper could become, and as Rebecca mentioned, the Speaker of the House has bought into that wholeheartedly. I mean, they've got diagrams of high-rise buildings and a technology corridor and mixed use and transit, and it would be a remarkable addition.
It'd be utopia,
I guess. Yeah, if it ever comes
that's a bad
to
word
comes
around,
to fruition, right? but yeah, I mean they've been sold this, and I think as I mentioned, the governor has included money in his budget for it. His administration is committed. Said over and over they want it moved.
But money to do what?
Well, that's
do you know?
Right now it's a little up in the air because they don't know how quickly the PRADA commission, this relocation commission, is going to be able to move. And so they've got $46 million in the budget. It could be to hire consultants to study new places. It could be to acquire land for the new site. It could be for planning and development, architectural designs and so forth. But the money's there. It's just sort of a lump to decide what they, depending on what the Prison Relocation Commission needs. They've got some money there available.
A little placeholder. That moves right into our next topic, which is the budget. And the governor unveiled his priorities yesterday. The big winner, as you reported, Robert, is education. Tell us more.
Well, I mean, education during the course of the recession kind of got like all state programs, I guess, was kind of going wanting. And so the economy is picking up. It grew at an unexpectedly brisk rate, I guess, in the last several months. The governor is proposing a lump sum going out to the school districts of about $160 million. That would be about a 6.25% increase in the per pupil spending, depending on how the districts want to use it. I mean, some of that may go to teacher development or things like that, but it's a sizable chunk. The governor said it's the largest increase in per pupil spending in 25 years. It's about on par with some of the increases they got in the boom right before the bust. But so it's a substantial amount. Educators are happy with it. There's some additional money in there for things like counseling and some other programs, but education is faring well in the governor's proposal. Now, throughout this, you have to keep in mind that this is the governor's proposal, and once upon a time, with a previous governor, there was a Senate president who, when I asked him about what he thought of the governor's budget proposal, he said, "Well, my table's much sturdier now," because he had used it to slide under the leg to keep it from wobbling. They don't often think of much of these, and there was already criticism from legislative leaders yesterday about the way the governor was sort of playing a little fast and loose with some of the revenue projections and some of the money he had available. They think he was sort of overpromising and building up unrealistic expectations. There's going to be some resistance to some of this. But yeah, education was one of the governor's top priorities. $360 million overall for public education, about $140 million for higher education.
And did he say that this is to address growth, or this is because we are flush with cash?
Well, there is money in there for growth. There's going to be about 8,000 new students coming in next year, and that's going to cost about $58 million, and that was part of his proposal. But it's also because, over the last several years, the education funding kind of was stagnant. Not so much last year and the year before, but the prior years during the recession. And so we're kind of trying to play a little catch up. Because everybody likes education, I guess, right? I mean, you ask voters, it's their top priority, typically either jobs or education. And Utah's education spending over the years has been last or second to last in the nation consistently. It's sort of trying to build up that commitment and trying to, get these test scores up. Some of the test scores we've talked about on this program before have not exactly been where the state would like them to be. And so there's going to be an effort in that regard as well.
Mm-hmm. Rebecca, I imagine that teachers are fully behind this proposal, even though it will be tweaked.
I would imagine they would be, but I think they've been around long enough in Utah to know that this is probably not going to be what they will end up with. I think they may be hopeful, but they're watching.
Okay.
There's a long time till the end of March.
Absolutely. Another priority he's putting his trust in body cams. Every highway patrol officer will get a camera. How's this going to fly with lawmakers, Robert?
Well, I think it's going to go over pretty well, actually, because there's a lot of conservative legislators who are suspicious, I would say, of the police authority and the power that the police departments have been exercising here in Utah and around the country. And so the governor is putting in $1 million. It's not going to buy body cameras for all of the troopers in the first year, but it's sort of going to be a phased in program where they're going to, over a few years, he wants to have every trooper have a body camera. He says it's good for the public and it's good for the troopers. If there's altercations or disputes over the way things played out, it's nice to have a video record that you can go to be a definitive decider on that, I guess. And so I think, and the other thing he said he wants to do, or his staff said he wants to do, is he wants to be an example. He wants the Utah Highway Patrol to be an example to other police departments around the state that this is something that can work, and this is something that they should all look at. I think among the legislature there's going to be a fairly, I don't expect too much opposition to that, frankly.
Is this where our money should go, George? Our colleague Aaron Alberti reported this week that West Valley is also looking to spend $1 million to equip its rank and file officers with body cams. I mean, what do you think?
Well, after what's happened here and in Ferguson and in New York, I mean, people are saying that this now becomes sort of the bare minimum for effective police work and for the police to earn some trust among the communities that they're policing. And I mean, we've talked about before about how this may not be as definitive as a NFL review with 47 cameras, but it is something that can protect the public if the police have gone rogue. It's something that can protect the police if they can prove with a body cam video that they did stay within the rules and they didn't use excessive force and they did adhere to policy. And I mean, as Robert said, the conservatism in Utah has a pretty strong libertarian streak, which isn't always necessarily to genuflect before the powers that be and the police. They have some concern that the police may be a little trigger happy sometimes and that the people deserve some opportunity to prove that.
Mm. Another budget priority, Healthy Utah. Now, this is the governor's sort of creative way to substitute for Medicaid money. And Rebecca, explain, how would it work?
Well, it would close the gap. There are people currently, about 63,000 people in the state, 63,000 to 67,000, depending on whose estimates you're going with, who are not covered. They make too much money to qualify for Medicaid, but they can't. They also cannot get subsidies for Obamacare. So this would help them get coverage under the Affordable Care Act. The governor wants to require them to work and to make copays and to contribute to their health care plan. The legislators have their own plan, and the two have to be reconciled somehow before this can go into effect. So a lot depends on what happens during the legislative session.
And Healthy Utah is sort of a tough political pill for many Utah conservatives to swallow because they don't want this federal money, or at least they have severe objections to the image of receiving federal funding. How is the governor going to persuade lawmakers to go along with this?
Well, I mean, I think he's got to try to reach out to Democrats and moderate Republicans and try to convince them that the argument he's made is that Utahns are paying taxes under the Affordable Care Act, and we can either let that money go to other states or we can try to recoup about $460 million of that money. And if we do nothing, these people are going to be uninsured. They're going to end up having, and we're going to end up paying for them anyway. And the money that we pay in taxes is going to go either into the black hole of the federal budget or go to be dispersed among other states. That's the argument he's going to have to make. There's a lot of resistance. I think it's a really tough sell for him because in the House. They're looking at options for, you know, using state money to try to cover some of those people, which again, you know, then you're losing that federal money. In the Senate, they've kind of been okay going up to cover people making up to 100% of poverty, but they don't really want to go from the 100% to the 138% that the governor's plan would do. So the governor's plan would cover people making up to about $32,000, I think, if I remember right, or maybe it was 28. And so there's that other sort of population that the Senate is reluctant to cover. So he's going to have to really work hard to do this. They think that the concern among the legislators is that by design, the Medicaid expansion is going to, the federal dollars are going to start disappearing in 2020. It's going to go down to 90% that they're going to be covering. We're going to have to come up with the 10%. Senator Niederhauser, President Niederhauser, said that that's going to cost about $93 million, cost the state about $93 million a year by the time the state's paying its share of it. And the governor and the legislature, if they're going to commit to that, needs to start identifying where they're going to get the money from in the out years, because they don't like the idea of expanding entitlements, and that's what this would essentially be. And they don't like creating more dependency on government. That's an argument you hear a lot from them. And they don't, you know, but they also, if they're going to do it, they want to be able to say, this is how we're going to pay for it. And so those are the things the governor is going to have to address, I think.
Mm-hmm. I mean, calling it a block grant, does that persuade people that it's a pilot project? I mean,
I don't think any of that will persuade lawmakers. They don't like to expand Medicaid. They don't like to expand social services and create larger pools of people who qualify and then start to depend on these things. Mm-hmm. I think it'll be interesting to see if the governor tries to say, look, the president himself signed off on these details, mm-hmm. and that's unusual. Utah got special dispensation from the White House. I don't know if that will persuade any lawmakers.
Yeah, he's made that argument. I think that may even sort of be more toxic than no, he said
yeah.
nothing.
Put that
don't
on the
bring
back
up
burner.
Obama.
Yeah, and you know, it's kind of funny because you hear from lawmakers, it's like, well, we're Utah, we can come up with our own solution. But
that's right.
You have to look at the track record, and in history, Utah has not come up with its own solutions on these things. It's sort of a pull yourselves up by your bootstraps thing, or go get some charity care, or go to your church and see if they can help you out. Mm-hmm. So now, you know, it's getting to be crunch time. We've only got about a month till the legislative session starts. It ends in mid-March. They've actually got to start putting their heads together and seeing if they can come to some agreement on something, if anything, on this.
George, the governor was flanked by a who's who panel behind him when he unveiled this Healthy Utah thing. Was it this week or last week? I can't remember. Anyway,
last week.
I mean, is that going to hold any influence? You had Gail Miller, you had Vivian Lee from the U, you had
the presiding bishop of the LDS.
Well, yeah,
and
we had
paramedical. Yeah, keep going on and on.
Yeah, well, we had, he like a king, he was flanked by two bishops, one from the Catholic Church and one from the LDS Church. This may undermine the idea that the legislature does what the church tells it to, because the church is on board. And the Catholic Church, the LDS Church and the Catholic Church are saying, pass this. Western civilization is saying, pass this. Utah is scared to death that it will join the rest of the Western world in making access to health care a bare minimum floor service as important as roads, streets, police, and schools. And the governor's in a tough spot. Like I say, on one side, he's got Western civilization, where health care is basic to existence. Every country in the world that we would consider civilized has solved this problem decades ago. On the other side, he's got the Utah legislature, which does not want to help people because somehow that makes them dependent or weak or something like that. And even the LDS Church is saying to pass this. So the idea that the legislature is at the beck and call of the church, well, at least we've undermined that.
Hmm. Well, in this case, this gives legislators a chance to say, see, we're independent.
You mentioned roads. Can we talk roads just
sure.
very briefly? You reported that transportation funding, not the big winner, but it is a favorite of lawmakers and the business community. Governor open to a gas tax? What?
Yeah. So there's two sort of moving pieces on this, and we'll hit them quickly, I guess. But one of the things the governor is concerned about is that right now there's about $580 million earmarked in the state budget. This is money that by law goes straight into specific programs. Most of them are water and roads. most of them are roads. There's some water. And so the governor wants to take about $94 million out of those earmarks and put it into education and other priorities that he thinks are more important than spending money on roads right now. Now, long term, he acknowledges, and legislators point out, that there's about, over the 30-year horizon, there's about a $7 billion need, unfunded need, that we're going to have to build $7 billion worth of roads, and we've got to come up with a way to pay for that. And maybe taking money out of these earmarks only exacerbates that problem. So the solution that they're discussing is either raising the gas tax, raising the sales tax, or finding some other way to pay for it. The gas tax in Utah hasn't been raised in 17 years. The governor said yesterday it would take about a 10 or 11 cent increase just to recoup the inflationary increase in that 10 or 11 year period. But he sees that as a logical way to do it, because frankly, you know, you've lost that buying power over the gas tax. And he says that roads, he thinks, should be paid for by the people who use them. And there's some logic to that. There's some doubt about the long-term viability of the gas tax, because A, cars are getting a lot better mileage right now. You have electric cars, you have hybrid cars that don't pay it, you have natural gas cars that don't necessarily pay it. So and so maybe the long-term viability of the gas tax isn't the way to go, but he wants to engage in the discussion, at least, of whether it's time to revisit the gas tax. In the legislature, there's some ambivalence about it, because, you know, it's been kicked around for the last several years, but right now the legislature is saying, well, hey, we've got all of this money. Why are we going back out to our taxpayers, to our constituents, and saying, yeah, we've got a $600 million surplus, but we would like you to pay more in gas tax because we need to build these roads. You know, they're not sure that now's the time to necessarily do that.
Can we just end up with that surplus money, $638 million? Lawmakers do not want to spend. They're not in a spending mood. And maybe explain why.
And this is going to be sort of the big point of contention, I guess. Theoretically, the governor and the legislature come to consensus budget numbers. But then after they came to those consensus budget numbers, the legislature wants to sock a bunch of the money away because they think that the economy right now is growing faster than it will long term. And so they think we're in a bubble. They want to put some of the money away so when the bubble bursts, they've got some money to fall back on. The governor says, well, we've got almost $500 million that's in the rainy day funds in these savings accounts. The economy is growing maybe a little faster, but it's not, you know, exorbitant. And we've got needs that we've kind of put off during the recession, things like building maintenance and things like that we need to pay for now. He says he needs these things now, and it's not the time to kind of just put money away. That and the money we talked about that he wants to take out of the earmarks leaves the legislature and the governor about $300 million away in what they're talking about actually spending. And so when you say that, when the governor says, I want a 6% pay raise or a 6% increase in education spending, it's hard for the legislature to get there when they're only going to be spending about half as much as the governor's talking about spending.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
George?
But the governor's done something kind of clever or sneaky, depending on your point of view. He set it up so that he's already budgeted taking money away from those earmarks and putting it in education. And if the legislature doesn't want to do that, they will not spend as much money on education, which could be spun as cutting education, although it would be reducing the increase. And the governor can say, see, I wanted to spend more money on education, and those nasty legislators wouldn't do it. They wanted to spend it on roads. And at the same time, he sort of talks about raising the gas tax, but the budget doesn't include that. So he's going to make the legislature be the bad guys and raise the gas tax.
And that is blatantly what he's done, because the roads money typically does not go to education, but he's done that. He's taken the roads money and put it in education. So they say, so then if they don't go along with that earmark reduction, then it comes out of education, and obviously the legislature doesn't like education, right? That's what everybody, and so he's kind of put them in a bit of a tough spot. And I think they're quite a ways apart right now. I was about as far apart as I've seen them in the last, you know, yeah, 7 years.
And you could make the argument that the legislature doesn't like education or not public education, but you don't necessarily want to have that hung around your neck.
Prudence, no. Politics,
yeah.
Yes.
It's all politics.
Okay, we're going to take a break. We're talking about the week's news, and we invite you to join us. 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. We'll be right back. You're listening to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW. Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce with the Salt Lake Tribune, and joining me in studio, Robert Gerke, Matt Canham, George Pyle, and Rebecca Walsh, all of the Trib. And you're welcome to join us, too. Put your comments at sltrib.com or tweet us to the hashtag TribTalk. It's time for our underplayed story of the week, the In Case You Missed It story. And let's start with you, George. What's on your mind?
Well, back to air quality. There are a couple of issues before the state right now. One of them is the power plant on the Indian Reservation. They're arguing about whether what the EPA wants to do is sufficient. At the same time, our friends in Heal, Utah were in talking to us about the regional haze initiative that would force the big coal-fired power plants in central Utah to cut back because it affects air quality as far away as the Grand Canyon.
Okay, that's a good story to continue to watch.
Comment Rebecca. Period through the 22nd.
There you go. Yes.
I think we all know a little bit about Jay Bybee, the BYU Law School grad who and assistant USAG who helped write the sign off on the torture memo, who now sits on the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. But I think it's also worth remembering that the two military psychologists who helped mastermind the methods used are also LDS, James Mitchell and Bruce Jessen, and they were paid $80 million in a federal contract to help develop this torture scheme.
Wow. So are they practicing? Are they believers?
They're still there, still making money, still have contracts. But I think it's an interesting sort of discussion to have in Utah in particular, because these are people of faith who somehow came around to the idea that torture was okay.
A very interesting story. Okay, let's go over to you, Matt. What you got?
In late August, the state's Utah Division of Consumer Protection came out really strongly against three e-cigarette companies who wouldn't say how they could return their products and were making health claims that were unsubstantiated. And they fined him $1.1 million.
It was a huge fine.
Huge fine, made a big statement about it, and then quietly negotiated, and those three companies paid $31,000. And now the state won't explain why they dropped the fine. It does appear that a couple of these companies just argued that they couldn't pay anymore. But it kind of goes into this idea of how do we regulate and monitor e-cigarettes. The state's going to deal with this for years to come, and I'm sure we'll see some of it at the legislature this year.
Mm, absolutely. Okay, Robert, what's your pick?
Well, in the omnibus bill that the Congress is considering to keep government
Cromnibus.
Operating, the Cromnibus bill, there's a rider in there that's supposed to protect sage grouse, or not supposed to protect sage grouse, supposed to prevent the government from enacting new protections for the sage grouse, this bird that is considered threatened and possibly endangered. This is a big win for the oil and gas industry, which says that if there are protections in place for this bird, it limits where they can drill and how much they can drill. And so, assuming this goes into effect, it could greatly alter the way that the states are looking at protecting these birds, and again be a win for the oil and gas industry.
Mm. I'm going to go closer to home. Two city hall stories. One is the Salt Lake City Council decided to postpone around-the-clock library. I'm not sure exactly why, but they're going to put that decision off, and I think it has a lot of residents in this neighborhood saying, phew. The second story is the Hoberman Arch story, which our colleague Chris Smart has been following, and it's this landmark piece of art that was an icon during the 2002 Olympic Games. The University of Utah took it off of its property. Salt Lake City was sort of caught flat-footed without a plan of where to put it. This week, some people stole a couple of pieces of the arch from a scrap metal heap on the impound lot for Salt Lake City. I think this is a tragedy, and I think city leaders are going to be wringing their hands on how to figure out what to do with this arch.
Well, and one of the really interesting things about this story is, like, the day it broke, Councilman Luke Garrett, who's going to be running against Ralph Becker, blamed it squarely on Mayor Becker's lack of leadership and lack of planning. And so this has already become a campaign issue.
Politics alive and well. Robert Gerke, Matt Canham, George Pyle, and Rebecca Walsh, all of the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks, guys, very much for your time today.
Thank you.
Thanks. Have a good weekend.
And we're going to wrap up this week with Tribune columnist Robert Kirby. This week, Kirby talks about putting up lights on the house during the holidays.
Yeah, it's sort of like trying to get home when you're drunk. It takes extra effort. And some people are better at it than others. Me, I only did it because my wife made me.
You say did. Do you not do it anymore?
Not on the roof anymore. She finally figured out after I fell off it a couple of times that I shouldn't be up there.
Yikes.
And my daughters won't let me do it either. I said, send one of their husbands over to the house and get it done. But we put them up, you know, on other places around the yard.
What's the fascination with lights, do you think?
I don't know. Is there something about the story of the virgin birth that says everybody's house has to look like a casino?
I don't know.
I don't think so.
Well, it is a common occurrence, particularly in Utah. People get into it. And you wrote about some adventures putting up lights back in 2009.
Yes, I did. I'll read from that column. The roof could have 6 inches of ice and a polar bear on it, and I'd still be getting bugged to climb up there dragging 4 miles of tangled light cord. I say this because my wife has seen me fall off the roof a lot, and it hasn't slowed her down a bit. It isn't Christmas without lights. 10 years ago, I stood on the peak of our roof in a snowstorm trying to adjust one flickering light in a string of 9,000 of them while my wife hollered up artistic direction. Suddenly, my feet shot back over my shoulders. I slammed down on my back and rode my spine 30 feet down a 6-12 pitch into the backyard where the doghouse did absolutely nothing to break my fall. When I could see again, my wife was standing over me with a look of genuine concern. It's still flickering, she said.
Do your neighbors put up lights?
Oh, yeah, both sides of me. They're light crazy about it, which is the only reason we still do is because we have to not appear to be Scrooges. And we have grandkids that come over. Where are your lights?
But you're not Clark Griswold.
No, I am not Clark Griswold. I do the minimal amount to make it look festive. And then I go inside and wish I could nail the door shut.
That's Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Kirby. Again, read more Kirby at sltrib.com. That's it for this edition of Behind the Headlines. Thanks to Jesse Ellis and Max McLeod. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce with the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks so much for listening. Have a great weekend.